my very great pleasure to introduce Peter Diane. Peter is actually the perfect person to be giving the talk at a multidisciplinary symposium because he's the most multidisciplinary person that I know, working on everything from theory of algorithms to reinforcement learning and through neuroscience, animal behavior, you name it. We frequently wait to the evening of the next submission to see what new topic Peter has been working on and has a single author paper that we never even knew that he studied. So Rich asked me to give a personal introduction, which Peter asked me to not do.
And who writes your recommendations? Good, I shall start.
I will say one personal thing. From the point of view of the apprenticeship learning of students of Peter, so you probably all noticed, if you've ever talked to Peter, that he speaks very fast. Also with very intricate and low-frequency vocabulary. But always the exact precise meaning of the word that should have been in that sentence. So I've learned through working with Peter that to take that as a compliment, because I think Peter speaks very fast. He thinks even faster. He types very fast. He knows to type on his keyboard because the refresh rate is so quick. And I think the fact that he speaks fast to us is because he assumes that we can infer as fast as he thinks. And one of the proofs of that, this is a legend because I've known Peter only since he's had kids, but people say that having kids made him speak slower. So he's updated the model so that we can understand. So let's welcome Peter. He'll talk about 3.5 theories of neural reinforcement learning, hopefully slow enough.
Thank you. So now that my kids are growing up, I can go back to normal speech. So Rich asked us to give us a slightly sort of personal story of how he came into the field. So first of all, I want to thank a large number of people. So particularly my forebears who had substantial forbearance. So particularly Andy Barter and Rich Sutton, who really defined the field and made it such a nice field. As Yael said, I work in a number of different fields, many of us do. And I think this, of all the fields, this is the nicest field. And I think the person to thank for that really is Rich, because he sort of makes sure that everybody continues to communicate and keep all these thinking together very well. But also a number of other people. Tony Dickinson had a huge impact over thinking of animal learning. So his book on contemporary animal learning theory, I really strongly recommend to any of you who have interest in this sort of direction. Wolfram, as you heard from this morning, a lot of the work on dopamine. Terry, we heard yesterday from the zebra finches. And Chris Watkins, who also many of you may have known from many of you may know from previous meetings like this, also had a very big impact. So, zebra finches, they're the people that hopefully we've learned to sing from. So I have some peerless peers, so people I've worked with over the years in this area. So Bernard Belain, who's at UCLA, a psychologist who used to work with Tony, Satinda, who's here, obviously the cause of this meeting, and Reed Montague, who unfortunately couldn't be here but is in Baylor. So our job collectively is to make these guys famous. And the people who are going to make us famous are our ascendant descendants. So this is, again, a number of the people who've done the work that I'm going to talk about. So Nathaniel Dorr, who was a postdoc, who's now at NYU. Quentin Hughes, who's back in London, who's a grad student. Sharm Kakaday, who's just moved to Penn. Yael at Princeton. And then two people who I've done imaging with. John O'Doherty, who's currently in Dublin. And Ben Seymour, who's also in London. Okay, so the other part of the story is Rich asked us to reflect again on how do we come to reinforcement learning. I realized that essentially my course through reinforcement learning is permeated by two bike crashes and a broken arm. So somehow in my career working in this field, there were sort of important things happened in each of these cases. So it's an interesting thing for the future. So in 1990, I was working in Edinburgh. I was a grad student in Edinburgh. And I was actually working first on TD because I was interested in the hippocampus and thinking about navigation. And then I came to America, actually came to visit Andy Barto, and had a bike crash. And so that's when I started working on TD Lambda, and the relationship between TD Lambda and how to understand, take Rich's ideas about proving the convergence of TD zero, and understand how to think about TD Lambda. And that's also how I then came to work on Q-learning. Then I went to work in San Diego, in Terry Sanofsky's lab, and I had another bike crash. And that's when I started working on some of the work that we heard about yesterday about octopamine, so the VOMX1, these B neurons, and also started working on dopamine based on the papers, papers that Morcombe had written. Then I went to Vancouver. So then I came to London, sorry, and I was working in Gatsby. And then I went to Vancouver for NIPS and broke my arm. It wasn't quite as bad as that, fortunately. This is a nice, gruesome figure. See?
In a bike crash?
No, I actually got run over by a car. Yes, those Canadians, you know, you think they're very nice, but maybe they're not. And that's when I started working on really the work that I'm going to talk about today, which is about, I got interested in the issue of motivation, something which Tony Dickinson and Bernard Belain have thought about a lot, and then the issue of multiple systems. So this is 3.5 theories. These are the multiple systems that came out through there. So I'm not sure what you should conclude from this as a good apprentice as you're learning, but I see that Dave Silver has a nice flag accident, so he's always obviously on the route to having a major theory about something. Okay, so one other slide of preamble. I think one of the great things about this field is that we can tie together a number of sort of precepts at very different levels of analysis. So David Marr, in his very famous book, Vision, had this notion of how should we study a computational problem in the brain, so something that the brain does. He said we should split it up into thinking about what the computational issues are, what's the system trying to solve, some of the issues we heard about yesterday from Rich. What are the algorithms and representations? So what are the, you know, this is the TD learning level, if you like. And then what's the neural substrate or the implementation? And these levels match very nicely, actually, with a set of biological questions which are studied in surprisingly separate domains. So computational issues, to some extent, are studied in ethology, optimal foraging. How do animals go about utilizing their patches, their resources, in optimal ways? From an algorithmic point of view, we know a lot from, you know, there's 100 years or more worth of animal behavioral psychology, which really informs a lot of the work that that we've heard about earlier on today, and that forms a lot of the work in this part of the field. And then from neuroscience, we heard from Terry about the zebra finches and about the bees, and then from Wolfram this morning about the dopamine system. And so RL operates, gives us ideas at all these different levels, and then links to these data, these huge bodies of data in ethology, psychology, and neuroscience. And that's, I think, is why it's really powerful. So the way we try to turn these principles into ideas for modeling, so normative models very clear. So obviously dynamic programming, we heard about again this morning, plays a very critical role in the way we think about things. Something you haven't heard about so much at this conference, but I'm sure permeated the whole of ICML, was sort of notions of Bayesian uncertainty. So a lot of the ways that we go about thinking about modeling issues in reinforcement learning come centrally from ideas about essentially uncertainty. You know, an animal starts off, it doesn't know something about the environment. That's why it has to do reinforcement learning. So the good way to characterize that it's ignorance is uncertainty. It's a form of uncertainty, something it doesn't know. So a lot of issues that we see in the way that animals learn about their worlds can be nicely captured by thinking about the uncertainty they have, how experience reduces that uncertainty. And we can go through a lot of these issues in the psychology of learning by thinking about what happens with the way that uncertainty gets propagated, represented, and processed. So things like learning rates come out of uncertainty. You know, you learn because you're uncertain about something. If you knew it already, you wouldn't learn it. So, you know, we can think about the way that psychologists think about learning by thinking about uncertainty. And the same is true for many other things. And here, we're going to think about uncertainty in terms of if you have more than one system that suggests what control that you might do, then maybe you use something about the uncertainties of those systems in order to choose what the right thing to do is. So I learned one other thing in all my years in RL, which is that scalars are easier than vectors. To put that more politely, is that these neuromodulatory systems that we heard, like this octopamine neuron that we saw, or the dopamine neurons that Wolfram showed, they're like scalar systems. That's not quite true. That's a bit of a generalization. But if you compare them to the things that they project to, like the striatum in the case of the dopamine neurons, or the mushroom bodies in the case of the octopamine neurons, or the prefrontal cortex, they are much, much more complicated. So we, I think, the traction that RL has in this world is because the bits of neuroscience that we've been able to really make the most progress with are scalar systems. And so that's why it's, you know, great to have these neuromodulators on board. Okay, so my plan for today is to talk about three theories of instrumental conditioning. So model-based RL, which in the psychology community is sometimes called goal-directed learning. model-free reinforcement learning, which we'll think of in terms of habitual learning, and then I'll say a word about episodic RL or episodic, which we're just trying to advocate as being another way of, another sort of source of controlled information. Then I'll talk about the half theory. So it's only a half theory because these ones come with both values and actions. This one, here you're not learning the actions. So here you're learning just predictions of the future, of future good things and bad things, roughly speaking. And those predictions come automatically attached to a set of actions that you do. We heard a little bit about that in Wolfram's talk this morning. So, and in Terry's talk yesterday, so the, you know, like the B proboscis extension. So there are automatic actions associated with predictions. Those actions can sometimes be good actions. Evolution might have given you, programmed you up the right way. But sometimes they can be bad. And when they go bad, that leads to what we're going to call Pavlovian misbehavior. So this is the half, the half theory. Then I'll then spend a few minutes talking again, prompted by Rich, about where I see the future of some of these issues is going to be. Okay, so Quentin Hughes comes from one of my students I mentioned before comes from Liechtenstein, and so when he came to London, I guess you know he had his eyes set on an extremely large residence, which is not that cheap in London. So he was and he designed his this slide with respect to thinking about a decision making problem from the perspective of going to his house and then meeting an atrium where he lives, not something I have at my house. And then from the atrium, there are two actions he could go left or right to left room or right room, and then he could go to like a living room, a bedroom, a study, or a kitchen. And then he was imagining you have a different, a motivational state of being tired that defines the utilities of the outcome. So it's good to go to the bedroom, bad to go to the study, and the others are in the middle. So with respect to this, we can think of, as the field has thought of substantially, two very different sorts of control mechanisms, a goal-directed control and habitual control. So goal-directed control, we can think of, you know, builds a model, right? Knows the model these sets of actions, and then sitting at the atrium decides whether it's going to go, it's a good idea to go left, because if I'm going left, I can then get to the bedroom, which is worth four utils. So in this case, the goal-directed system has to know the transition matrix we heard before, and also the values of the outcomes. And then the counterpart to that, so model-free reinforcement learning, which we've mostly focused on in this workshop, is learn something like the Q values or an adiacritic type structure. Learn something about the values of these actions, relying on extensive sampling. The idea there is it knows this value of going left as being 4, but doesn't know why it's worth 4. Now, there could be some other horrible tree sitting underneath this, which is why it's actually worth 4. But in this habitual system, it's very easy to have. The third system, the Pavlovian system, which is somewhat evolutionary fixed, maybe only has very simple actions here, which is approach or avoid. So maybe if you're on the left room, then the Pavlovian system might say it's a good idea to go here because this is because there's a high value to the bedroom, so it just does an approach response to that. Or here it might say it's a bad idea to go to the study. So it's not something which maybe propagates back through the tree at all. It's just something associated with the values. And the way the psychologists distinguish at least between the goal-directed system and the habitual system is by changing motivation, the motivational structure, as far as they can for the first time for an animal. So now if we make Quentin, we wake him up, he's now awake rather than being tired. So now it's obviously more valuable for him to go to the study than to the bedroom. And then if habitual learning requires extensive sampling, then when we change the motivational state, it's going to take a while for it to learn the new Q values associated with this motivational state. And so behavior which doesn't show any change when you change motivation is not being controlled by the goal-directed system, which should change straight away, but instead maybe being controlled by the habitual system, which takes a while to learn. So that very simple idea, something which has been used a lot by Tony Dickinson and Bernard Belain, to try and understand the architecture of goal-directed and habitual control in the rat brain, and then has been used by John O'Doherty recently to look at the same architecture in the human brain. Okay, so the goal-directed system, model-based RL, very simple. It's like so for those of you who could study Psychology 101 may have come across Tolman, who was a psychologist who defined himself really in opposition to the big behaviorist movement in the early-ish part of the last century. And so he's very interested in the idea that animals build up cognitive maps. They have a sort of structure of their environment and then use those maps in order to do their controls. So Tolman's, the model of the tree structure there would be exactly the sort of thing that Tolman would have thought of as being a cognitive map. And then with respect to that map, you can do something like forwards or backwards tree search to work out what a good action is in order to optimize your behavior. So here's the experiment, this motivation experiment I was referring to. These are cartoons come from Bernard Belain. So here you train an animal, a rat, to press a lever when it's hungry in order to get cheese. You can train it either for a few trials or a lot of trials. You then devalue the cheese. For instance, here you pair it with illness, so with lithium chloride, makes the animal ill, lying in its hospital bed. At that point, you do it without showing it the lever at all. So it just has re-experiences of this cheese, gets ill from the cheese. So the idea is that that is going to reduce the value of the cheese to the model-based system. It knows cheese isn't a good idea to have. Then you come back and test it, and you see, is the animal willing to press this lever to get the cheese? So what you see is a rather funny thing, which is after moderate amounts of training, so a few trials when they've learned to press this lever, you see that the animal is less willing to press the lever to get this cheese after this moderate training, after you've devalued it, than it was before. So the open bars here show you how willing an animal would be who hadn't been paired with illness would be, how many actions per minute it would do, a rate of pressing to get the cheese. The solid bar shows you that he's less willing to do that after it's been paired. In fact, the way this works is if you gave him the cheese, he wouldn't actually eat the cheese at all. So it's still, in a sense, surprising it's doing any of these actions at all. But after extensive training, you train a little bit longer, or somewhat longer, with these animals, now you come back and you see that even though you've devalued it, even though if you gave him the cheese, he wouldn't eat the cheese, nevertheless, he still happily presses the lever to get this stuff he doesn't actually want. And humans do exactly the same. So John O'Doherty did this study just recently with M&Ms, you know, these little smarty things, if you haven't in Canada. And he trained subjects over a couple of days to press a lever to get M&Ms. And then he wasn't unfortunately able to poison the M&Ms. So what he did instead was he gave them the opposite. He gave them as many M&Ms. He basically forced them to eat so many M&Ms, they were very uninterested in seeing any more M&Ms in their life. Then he brought them back, and then he gave them the decision-making task, where again, pressing the lever, all it does is get you an M&M. And in fact, the way they do that, they don't even give you the M&Ms at the end. And subjects would still do the job in his task to get these M&Ms that they weren't in the least bit interested in eating. So you and the rat, or us and the rats, are all at this level essentially the same. Okay, so based on this analysis, we know based on the sort of neurobiological analysis, we know something about the structures involved. So the prefrontal cortex, that was one of the targets that we saw in Wolfram's wave this morning. And the dorsomedial striatum, another target of the dopamine system, seems to be involved in this goal-directed control, the stuff that does devalue like this. So what's the characteristics of this controller? So we said Bayesian uncertainty is important. Well, there are two characteristics. Statistically, it's very efficient. Now, we heard that actually a bit in Dimitri's talk this morning, right? This learning a model of a domain is extremely easy. You know, if you want to learn the transitions, you start at a state, you take an action, you get to another state, and you record that as a piece of punctate experience you can write down. And that fits exactly the right place in the tree. You know that's exactly what you should do. So it's statistically extremely easy with respect to a stationary world to learn what the characteristics of the world are. However, search in this model you could think of as being computationally catastrophic. Right? It's very difficult to search these models. So we devote a lot of effort in our swanky Monte Carlo search methods in order to search models which are like these sorts of tree models. And you think of the poor hapless rat trying to use its prefrontal cortex to remember these paths or to develop these new online policies we see being so effective in Go. That's obviously a very difficult thing to do, and it's probably very associated with noise. So this is a great thing to do from a statistical point of view, but computationally it's tough. And that balance is going to mean that there are some parts of space where this is a good controller and some parts of space where it's not a very useful controller to have. And that's going to be the trade-off that we're going to argue is going to lead to this case. Oh, sorry, I should say this data comes from Peter Holland. Okay, what about the habit system? Well, in this community, we obviously don't need to talk about that too much, but basically the habit system is just what comes out of Q values or one of these. Actually, one of the interesting things at the moment is people are exploring the neural representation of different sorts of model-free reinforcement learning in the brain. But let's say we can think of one essentially using, say, Q values or maybe advantage values as a way of doing control in this domain, just learning these numbers without actually doing explicit search. So we use here, because we're interested in uncertainty, we use a version of Bayesian Q learning from Dearden and Russell and Andrew. Okay, so this is model-free and cached. So by cache, it means like you have these, you're sort of storing up in a cache the value of doing all this exploration as you go through the domain. We know from Bernard Blaine and Tony and Simon Kilcross that it involves the dorsolateral striatum, and it has this critical involvement with dopamine that we heard about this morning from Wolfram. And the key thing is, because of the way you learn these values, it's motivationally insensitive. So it has this property here that when you devalue the cheese, because they do it in such a way, the animal doesn't experience the cheese associated with doing the actions. So it doesn't. It means that it doesn't know that the new value of the cheese is low rather than high. And so it doesn't know that the new value of pressing the lever to get the cheese is low rather than high. And therefore, it quite happily presses the lever that it shouldn't do, just like the subjects were quite happily pressing their getting their M&Ms, even though there was no value to them for getting those M&Ms. Okay, so this has exactly the opposite characteristics from the model-based RL. It's from a computation point of view, it's very congenial. You just have a set of Q values. You know straight away, you know, it's very easy to optimize over what action you should do, because you know you have immediate signature of what the quality of each of these actions is. That's just what the Q value is supposed to do for you. But statistically, it's inefficient because you have to learn it by these statistically, by following these paths, following your nose through these TD mechanisms. You're not allowed to store intermediate quantities like these C matrices we heard from Dimitri this morning, or the Ds. Instead, you're going through with just using essentially primitive experience, which is a great thing to do. But it means that it takes you longer to learn, more samples to learn. And so there's a balance between these two sorts of controller. So what we expect is that because this is statistically inefficient, you don't want to use this controller too early on, because it's not going to have you're not going to have had enough time to learn it. On the other hand, you are going to want to use it late on, because it's computationally very easy to use. So it has a big advantage over model-based control after you've learned enough about the domain in order that its Q values are correct, because it's a much easier decision problem to use at that time. There's much less noise associated with the decision making that should come along with that. And so what we suggested is that Nathaniel Dorr, Yael and I suggested is that that's essentially what's going on in this switch from the moderate training to extensive training, is a switch from model-based reinforcement learning to essentially model-free reinforcement learning, and a switch to different structures in the brain that we know are involved. Okay, so we saw this picture from Wolfram this morning, and these dopamine cells. So I'm just going to say a little word you're going to have just a couple of slides in this talk about some other ways that we try to measure things about reinforcement learning in neuroscience. So just to remind you, this is a picture of the human brain, our favorite primate. Here are the dopamine cells. This area is the ventral tegmental area and the substantia nigra pars compacta that Wolfram was recording from. They have their major projections to the striatum, so the caudate nucleus and putamen. This is the structure. It's these neurons which first start dying. Sorry, it's these neurons, the substantia nigra, which project to the striatum, which first start dying in Parkinson's disease, and that lead to the behavioral problems like the rigidity and the tremor. And in fact, the system is so well calibrated that you can lose around 80% of the cells before you see any observable symptoms. So as you can see, these are mission-critical systems, and so they're subject to huge amounts of feedback, regulatory feedback of various sorts. And then the other structures, the nucleus accumbens, this seems to be particularly involved in affective valuation, so valuation of things which are positive and negative affect. And then the prefrontal cortex that we saw before. And there's also a link to the amygdala, which is what we saw some recording from in Wolfram's talk earlier. So then these are, just to remind you, these are the activities of dopamine cells. So these are a number of trials. Each trial here is shown by a single line. Each dot is the spike of a single neuron. These histograms compile all the spikes over a little time bin there. You see that when you get unexpected reward, as we know, you get these firing of the dopamine cells. When you get a predicted reward, you get a stimulus which predicts a future reward. You get the firing of the dopamine cells associated with the CS. Associated with this predictor. You don't see any, there's no prediction error at the time of the reward, you see nothing. Then when the reward gets emitted, you see the prediction as before, the animal doesn't know it's being emitted. When it actually is emitted, you see this dip in firing rate of those neurons. So this is just a very primitive, a simple demonstration that these neurons are showing what you'd expect for a sort of prediction error. And in fact, in the one of the posters yesterday from Rob Routledge and Paul Dimsher, they showed some other data which relate, and I'll show you some neural imaging data which also relates to why we think this structure is involved in making these predictions, doing these prediction errors. So this is why we think, from a predictive point of view, that these structures are involved in model-free control, right? Because they're doing the signature we need, which is this learning, this prediction error-based learning rule we need for model-free control. Okay, so in this work, what you can see, so in our model of these of this very simple experiment, what we have is two systems, the cache system, model free, the tree system, model based, and two quantities, expected values and uncertainties. So we look at the expected value. What you see is that the tree system and the, so both systems, model-based and model-free, both learn over the course of trials what the value of the cheese is. So they're pressing this lever to get to the cheese. And what you see is, if we suddenly devalue the cheese, we can ask the model-based system what the new value is, the model-free system. And the idea is the model-based system in blue knows that after devaluation, the value of the cheese is not very high. Whereas the model-free system has no idea about the value of the cheese. You know, it's not using that information when it's coming to think about the, to think about whether it's worth pressing the lever or not. After substantial learning, you know, the same is true. The model-based system is still well aware of the new value of the cheese. The model-free system is still happily ignorant because it hasn't had any opportunity to learn about that. However, you shouldn't just believe the system which says that the value of doing the action is biggest. What you should do is to assess the systems based on how uncertain they are. And if you remember, there are two different sources of uncertainty. There's essentially uncertainty from ignorance and uncertainty from computation. Uncertainty from ignorance is particularly bad for the model-free system, the cache system here, because it learns so inefficiently, so it's statistically inefficient for learning. So although both systems decrease their uncertainty over time, you can see that we expect the model-based system to be less uncertain than the model-free system early on in learning. Whereas late on in learning, now both systems had a chance to, the model-free systems had a chance to learn a substantial amount about the domain. But now the model-based system gets uncertain because the computations are associated with noise. So the way that we model the difficulty of computation is to say that it gets corrupted by noise. And that's going to then add uncertainty to the output of that system, which means it's not going to be so reliable. So what we expect is, if you interrogate this system with devaluation early on in learning, the model-free system is less certain than the model-based system. So the model-based system will dominate it in terms of behavior. And that means that because the model-based system knows the new value of the cheese is low, you won't get much pressing, you'll get less pressing of the lever for that. Whereas late on in learning, when now the model-free system has a lower uncertainty than the model-based system because it doesn't suffer this computational noise. And so now there's no reason when you devalue, because it doesn't know about the new value of the cheese, so it still quite happily presses the lever. It's a very simple idea, but sort of captures quite a bit of the data in this field. So under what circumstances can we return control? Can we make sure that the tree-based system is going to win forever? So it turns out that gold-rated control is going to be favored by various things. So one is proximity to the outcome. If we make the problem easier, so fewer steps in the tree, then the gold-directed system can survive for longer. And that's just what happens. If you look at the actions which are closer to the outcome, they continue to be devalued even after extensive training. And the other thing you can do is to make the problem more uncertain by having change or having more options. And again, you can do that in such a way that always favors the tree-based system over the model-based control over model-free control. So that makes sense, again, from a Bayesian uncertainty point of view of what's going to control performance. Okay, so that's two systems. Now here's a third system, which is a bit more speculative. So to introduce this, let me tell you an experiment by Packard and McGaw. So they trained rats in what's called a cross maze, and they always started them in the south position, and they always trained them to get to a reward in the west position, I guess, that is west from here. And what they're going to do is they're going to test the rats by putting them in the north position and ask, do they go to one of two places? So one place they could go is the place defining the reward, i.e. being west, like this. The other thing they could do is to do the action which defines getting the reward, which is to go left. So if they go to the place, they'll get here. If they do the action, they'll get here, because turning left, if you start in the north, is going to get you here rather than here. So what they showed is, again, they did the same manipulation of looking after small amounts of learning or large amounts of learning. But here what they did was to inactivate a system which is involved in both learning, so episodic memory, so that's like individual personal experience memory, and is also involved in spatial behavior in the rats. And so they inactivated either this part of the hippocampus or part of the striatum that we saw in Wolfram's talk, which seems to be involved in model-free control. After either a small amount of training, 8 days, or 16 days of training, so varying the amount of training in these cases. And remember, when they test them, they don't provide them with any reward here in these cases, so they just can see where the animals think that the reward, express their belief about where the reward is. And what they do is they have a cannula into these systems. They can deliver lidocaine, which is an anesthetic. So they can temporarily inactivate either the hippocampus or the striatum and see what happens. And what you see is, if you test on test day 8, then they always go to the place that defined the reward. They always go west, unless they inactivate the hippocampus, in which case they go to the they do the action, they go left. So here, what you're seeing is the place is in the open, and the response, the action is in the closed. And you see they will always go to the place unless they inactivate the hippocampus. If you test after 16 days, you see exactly the opposite. Now they always go to the response. They always do the action here, unless you inactivate the dorsolateral chordate, in which case they then go to the place defined by this. So this is evidence which suggests a couple of things. So one is it suggests that you have both these systems are learning and are available for doing control at all the points in over the course of this task. So here the animal knew what to do. It wasn't that the hippocampus no longer knew where the reward was. It's just that it didn't get to express its desire about where to go in the behavior of the animal unless you inactivated other mechanisms for doing control, the striatum in this case. Likewise here, the striatum does know what to do, but it just doesn't get to control behavior unless you do lidocaine on the unless you get rid of the hippocampus here. And the other, so that's one thing it does. And the other thing it suggests is that maybe this structure, this hippocampus, also gets to play in terms of control, as well as the prefrontal cortex, as well as other structures that are involved in control. The reason we think this is interesting is because there's actually an interesting movement at the moment in cognitive science, thinking about why is it a good idea to have episodic memory. So it's nice for us to have this sort of full, refulgent view of our past. But under what circumstances is that going to lead to good quality control? You know, presumably you remember the past in order to do control for some reason. So you could just remember the general statistics about the past, and that would be quite perfectly good for doing control in some cases. So why do you ever need to have these episodic recall, this idea you can recall little snapshots of your past? And we're thinking of this as in this context. So the hippocampus is this structure which is involved in place, but is also involved in this sort of snapshot learning. And the idea is that after a really small amount of experience in a domain, it's actually a good idea to use just that little piece of experience. So imagine you come to a city like Montreal for the first time. Then if you have one experience, you go to a nice restaurant enjoy the food there. Then if I then send you back to Montreal and ask, well, now where are you going to go? Where would you like to go and eat? You had one experience in this city. You know it's a big city. You know there are going to be lots of restaurants. You have a huge amount of uncertainty. So your model-based controller, you could think about, well, all the things you should go and do to work out how to go and find a good quality restaurant in this city. But, or you could just use this one piece of experience you've had, which was this was a particularly good restaurant at that time, so you could just go and reuse that one little piece of experience. So we're trying to argue that there's a sort of episodic reinforcement learning process as well, where you just take individual episodes and essentially just generalize from those. Now, of course, that is not going to be a good idea over a large, if you have the opportunity to do a lot of exploration or to do many more samples. But if you don't have an opportunity to do that, you might expect that there will be a time that, in fact, this episodic controller will dominate over the model-based controller. So now we have three controllers in a row. Episodic controller, after really limited experience. Model-based controller, after a little bit more experience, so you've got your statistical model up and running. And then you have a habitual controller, this sort of action-based controller, which is there after you've had a substantial experience. And so it may be that in the intermediate control, in some circumstances, just get edited out altogether. Okay, so our episodic controller just stores conjunctions of states, actions, and rewards. And if it gets a particularly good reward, like bigger than some maximum, for instance, then it stores all the actions in the episode, and then just chooses the action that was rewarded, otherwise it just does something random. So it's a really, really dumb controller, but nevertheless, it's probably a useful controller when you have really extreme amounts of uncertainty, in which case it's not simply worth trying to plan in the forward model. Now, a slightly alternative is that maybe this episodic system just contributes to the forward model instead. It's not really a whole controller by itself. And therein lies a debate about the nature of the connections between the hippocampus and aspects of the striatum. So does the hippocampus get to be a good quality controller by itself, or does it have to exert its control by influencing other systems? And in fact, we don't really know the answer to that. Okay, so here's the architecture of these three instrumental controllers. We have goal-directed control, or model-based RL, habitual control, model-free RL, and episodic control, a sort of instance-based RL, if you like. So that seems to involve the prefrontal cortex, the dorsal medial striatum, areas we saw before, and another area of medial prefrontal cortex called the prelimbic cortex. So I haven't really got time to go into why the importance of these different structures. Habitual control involves somewhere else. The dorsolateral striatum, so a different bit of the striatum, the amygdala we saw this morning. It involves neuromodulators, so particularly dopamine. We've been arguing, somebody asked about punishment. We've been arguing that the serotonin, another neuromodulator, which is a bit more complicated than dopamine, may have a particular role to play in punishment. And then there's also a number of other structural features which are very interesting in habitual control. So, for instance, the striatum isn't a uniform structure, and it doesn't have a uniform connection with the dopamine system. It's been argued that there's almost like a helical connection structure between the striatum and the dopamine system. So one part of the striatum, the most ventral part of the striatum, projects the dopamine cells. They then project partly back to that part of the striatum, and partly a bit more dorsally, so the next bit of the striatum. And then those dorsal bits of the striatum project to the next bit of the dopamine cells. They project back to themselves, and a little bit more dorsally. So you get a spiraling connection through the striatum. And some people have tried to argue that along with these spirals, you actually have a change in the semantics of the control that goes along the spiral. So it goes from being actually Pavlovian control to something a bit like Q-value-like control or advantage-like control to something like embedded active-critic-like control as you go further. So that's very speculative. But certainly we know that there are these spirals. And in fact, it's very interesting to think about what the structure is. In fact, there was an interesting poster yesterday by Wolfgang Pauli and Randy O'Reilly where they're thinking about the spirals in a slightly different way. And then episodic control, I should also mention the work that Yael did for a thesis on thinking about another aspect of probably habitual control, which is to do with the tonic levels of dopamine and the vigor of responding, which I think is going to be much better illuminated by the sorts of experiments that actually Peter Schisgal is doing looking at brain stimulation reward, which is a particularly good mechanism for understanding how some of these issues are working in rats. So episodic control involves then the hippocampus, we know, and we're not sure about the output structures of that. Now, one of the real things that happens, the reason why, in a sense, probably I'm talking to you today, is that we've been able to use these models to do essentially model-based electrophysiology and fMRI. So we heard in Wolfram's talk about the way these models have influenced neurophysiological findings, so the experiments that he's been doing. So I'm just going to show you a couple of slides about showing some fMRI results where you're doing something very similar, where we use these reinforcement learning ideas to go and interrogate the brain. So functional magnetic resonance imaging, I'm sure you all know, is a big scanner where you can go and measure essentially blood flow in different parts of the brain based on its magnetic properties. So blood flow is just blood flow, but it is actually surprisingly unknown that blood flow tells us something about the activity in different parts of the brain. So here's a study that Yael did, where we were interested in processing risk, something we heard about yesterday and today. So what Yael did was to have four different stimuli, which are predicting different sorts of outcomes. So this is a human experiment, so the stimuli are like visual experiments to the subject lying in the scanner. And then there's one stimulus where they would get, after a period, they would get 40 cents of reward. Another stimulus where they'd get 20 cents, so you can't see that very clearly. And then there was another stimulus they got 0 cents. And then there's another stimulus where it was 50-50, either they get 0 cents or 40 cents. So this is, what Yael's showing here is the TD signal you would expect based on a naive coding of TD, a linear coding of the prediction error, across the trial. So what you see is, for the sure 40 cent stimulus, you see a big spike of essentially 40, worth of 40 cents when the stimulus comes on. When the reward comes, it was perfectly expected, you see nothing. Likewise, then these ones here, so it's 0, 40 with probably 50-50. Then when this first comes on, you see 20 cents. And when at the time of the reward should be there, if you do get the reward, you get another 20 cents. You're surprised. If you don't get it, then you get the minus 20 cents there. You're not surprised. So this is a model of what we would expect the TD error to be. So if we were to be recording in the brain, what would we expect? Well, there's a coupling between the way that activity, neural activity in the brain, gets coupled to the blood flow signal, which you can measure through fMRI. So it's a very slow and sort of squashy process, which is shown by this impulse response function, which is this is time in seconds. So you can see that what you do is convolve these temporal stimuli with this slow hemodynamic response function to make a prediction about what signals you would expect to see in the striatum based on, or expect to see in the areas associated with this dopamine system, associated with all these different stimuli. So, for instance, the one with 40 cents, after the stimulus comes on, you see this big rise, which looks like that. The one which is 40 cents and 0, 40 cents, and you win, you get a smaller rise, then you get a positive bit which responds to this. The 40 cents and you lose, you get essentially the same response as this as the solid one, but then it goes down to reflect the fact you've lost in this case here. And then the 0 one is essentially flat. The reason it's not flat has to do with the dynamics of the overall experiment, because in fact you can see this is 30 seconds, so we don't know the time period of the hemodynamic response function means that one trial will sort of bleed into the next in a way that you have to then essentially worry about. So what Yael did was to ask somebody to essentially snip out, it turns out in these sorts of studies, what you should do is it turns out to be best to look not at the dopamine cells themselves, but rather at the target structure of the dopamine cells, because maybe that's where the blood flow seems to be most influenced. And it's unfortunate that we don't know that coupling. You know, we have no real idea about what that coupling is like at the level of the striatum. But we know from other studies that a good place to look is the areas which are targeted by those dopamine cells in this case. So what she did was ask Laura D'Souza to mark out on an anatomical scan where the nucleus accumbens is, this part of the striatum, which is targeted by the dopamine cells. And so we could then find out where it was. And then we could ask the neural signal, the fMRI, we say, what was the activity like in those areas based on the different sorts of trial types that we have? And when you do that, what you see is a signal which is almost exactly like the signal we expected from TD. So what that is, if you look here, that the major features of this, so for instance, you see, look at the one, the 40, where it goes, where you don't get rewarded, it goes up and then goes down. You see the same thing goes up and then goes down. So these features are a similar quality of match to the temporal difference, you know, this simple TD signal that I think we see in Wolfram's case, in the case of the dopamine cells. And this is a result, this is just, in a sense, the cleanest expression of that result in the accumbens. There was another clean expression we saw actually in the poster yesterday, which is a result which many other labs also got. So I think this is a fairly well established. Yeah.
Why is the yellow line so wiggly in the
human section? Well, so there are a number of reasons for that. So you could ask, it's also a little bit wiggly here, which is to do with the time. So one big problem we have here is a sort of generalization effect. So in fact, here, subjects had to learn the values of the stimuli. So one of the key innovations in this study, one of the key points of this study, was we didn't tell them ahead of time what the value of the stimuli were. They just had to learn them from experience. And what you often see in that case is a sort of generalization-like responses, or you get, you know, basically they may be slightly confused-like responses from the subjects. And so in the case of monkeys, what you see when you get generalization responses, often when you get the CS that they shouldn't respond to, you see in the dopamine cells, you see a firing bigger than baseline. And then you get a sort of firing less than baseline as if to correct the error. In fact, you can generalize that actually as being a sort of partial effect of a sort of simple approach to partial observability. And so that might be one of the things that's going on here. So there are many things that may underlie these sorts of signals. But the thing that we found convincing is to think about the basic structural features of these responses, which look very similar to that. So we had, I think we had 18 subjects, of which we then threw away 3, is that right, because of, for various reasons? 16 then, so we moved in 19 threw away 3. Okay, I was going to tell you about pain, but since it's Canada, I won't. Okay, so that's the 3 good quality systems. Now I'm going to tell you about the Pavlovian misbehavior, briefly. Okay, so we, in reinforcement learning, often sort of elide a little bit the relationship, the sort of psychological basis of some of the signals that we're, or some of the learning we're thinking about. So a lot of the early work that Rich and Andy did in this field was based on actually classical conditioning. So those studies actually, if you think about it, are kind of weird. You present a stimulus to an animal, like a light. You feed him, give him some food later on. Then you show him the light again and ask, what does he do? But it is classical conditioning, which means there's nothing the animal had to do in response to the light in order to get the reward. It's just that animals are wired to do various things when they make these predictions. So there seems to be a sort of evolutionary programming that says it's a good idea to do certain actions when you make predictions of certain things. And this is actually best understood or best seen in the aversive control. And you can think of a good reason for that, which is you don't want to have to learn from personal experience what to do if a lion roars behind you too frequently. So there's a structure called the periaqueductal gray. So it's actually a structure I'm showing here, which is sort of not that far above the spinal cord. And in fact, on the PAG, what you see is actually a topographic mapping of a set of good things to do when you are threatened in particular ways. So there's a dorsal aspect and a ventral aspect. The ventral aspect is like passive coping strategies. So that's the one thing you do where it's like almost repair strategies. And then the dorsal aspect, you have a different set of active coping strategies. And it's arranged. It's such a beautiful level of detail. It's reported, for instance, there are two things that I might do if Rich is threatening me. One is, one is to fight him. The other is to run away, which would be a best strategy. And so it's ordered of fighting and running away. So fight and flight are actually represented on different parts of this structure. And so you can do that by activating it. And you might think, for instance, I want to run away. I want to direct blood flow towards my legs so I can run away fast. Whereas if I want to punch Rich, I want to have blood flow in my arm so I can punch him more effectively. And it's and in fact, there's essentially a mapping even at the level of that level of detail of what I'm going to do in face different threats from Rich. So that's to say we have a very beautiful set of controls of, this is a picture comes from Bandler and Blanchard and Blanchard. And so we have a beautiful set of controls of what to do in these aversive cases. And that's going to be true in appetitive cases too. So there are consummatory actions. These are things you get when you get the outcome. So like licking or gapes. So that's like for good things and bad things. And preparatory actions, which are things that really bother us the most, like approach and withdrawal. So you want to approach good things and withdraw from bad things. So then what you can, and there are a number of uncertainties actually about this, not nearly as well worked out as in the case of instrumental conditioning in a way. But there are then lots of cases where as experimenters we can pit these instrumental systems, these nice three sort of theories of control, against this other half theory of control, and show the other half theory works seems to outcompete it. So I haven't got time to go through all of them, but let me just tell you one, which is one of my favorites, which is a study by Hirschberger called About Chicken in a Looking Glass World. So here the idea is you have a chicken and a feeder, get this right. And the rules of the game are, if the chicken runs towards the feeder, where the food is, the feeder runs away at twice the speed. If the chicken runs away from the feeder, it runs towards him at twice the speed. So the way you get fed is by running away from your food as fast as you can. So needless to say, chickens can't learn that. Despite the fact it's a perfectly good, reinforcement learning would quite happily learn that. So that's an example of a competition between Pavlovian conditioning, which says approach your sources of food, and instrumental conditioning, which says do the right action in order to get fed, which in this case involves running away. And you can't do that. You can't learn that action. And that's the chicks can't learn that action, and I think that probably we wouldn't be able to learn that action either, short of my telling you what the rules are. And so that shows us that Pavlovian control, in some cases, can actually outcompete instrumental control too. So sometimes it's good. Generally, our food doesn't spend much of its time chasing us. But that's not always the case. And so as experimenters, we make that happen. So if you ask me at the end, I'll tell you about palm reading, which is another instance of this effect. So let me just briefly say an example paradox, which we used to think about Pavlovian control, or this Pavlovian instrumental interaction, to try and resolve a sort of paradox for us. So as we've heard extensively, dopamine seems clearly to report information about rewards. And there's a big battle about the other things that dopamine might report information about. There's substantial evidence throughout a huge number of different systems that one of the things that serotonin, this other neuromodulator, a bit like dopamine, but it acts in a different way, acts like an opponent to dopamine. So it seems in many cases to antagonize the things that dopamine does, and vice versa. So dopamine seems to be involved in approach responses. Serotonin seems to be involved in maybe more in withdrawal responses or in preventing approach responses. So you might think, if you're like naive theorists like us, that therefore serotonin should have something to do with reporting information about punishments. We've talked, discussed a little bit about pain and the consequences of pain this morning. So our bet for what the equivalent system to dopamine would be serotonin, based on this idea about opponency. I must say it's a theory which there's very little experimental support. And one of the critical problems with this theory, this critical paradox, is that, as you may know, boosting serotonin is one of the mainline treatments for depression, a case where you think that people are obviously not overly happy about the amount of rewards they're receiving. So SSRIs, like Prozac, are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which have the effect of boosting the length of time that serotonin accesses its target structures. So this was a clear paradox in terms of what might be going on with respect to our theory. So we've argued this is work done with Quentin Hughes, is that maybe what's going on is the critical role for serotonin is actually a Pavlovian role rather than this instrumental role. And its role is to essentially determine Pavlovian withdrawal or inhibition. So its job is that when you make a prediction of something nasty happening, you want to essentially avoid that by a set of actions. So those actions may be withdrawal or running away, or maybe fighting under certain circumstances. Or maybe if you're just stuck, locked in a set of train of negative thoughts, you just want to inhibit that set of negative thoughts and just don't think those thoughts. So this becomes, because you have this Pavlovian control system, this becomes a crutch which instrumental control can depend on. It doesn't have to learn what actions to do in that case, your instrumental system, because in fact the Pavlovian system is already in control. It's literally doing the set of actions which are appropriate for that case. And that means that if something goes wrong with 5-HT, with serotonin, then you lose that crutch. You lose this underlying mechanism of control. And that means that you run into those negative thoughts you were going to do before. You fail to inhibit actions which lead to nasty outcomes. So we know that there's an impulsivity comes if you have problems with, if you reduce a 5-HT. And there's an interesting phenomenon, which some of you may have heard of, not the most solid phenomenon, but called depressive realism, which is that normal subjects are over-optimistic about the nature of the world and the amount of control they have over the world. Whereas in tests, subjects who actually are depressed actually are realistic about the sort of nasty world that they live in. And so, this is the same thing. We're optimistic because we have this nice way, controlled by serotonin, putatively, of editing out all those nasty things that you might think, which might actually really happen, but you just essentially choose not to think about them. And so that's the way that you can think about this interaction between Pavlovian instrumental control can actually resolve interesting paradoxes in these domains. Okay, so let me just say a word about the future. I sort of divided out some thoughts about the future of sort of neural RL into four different categories. So lots of instrumentational questions, some representational questions, some hierarchical questions, and then the last one is to do with computational psychiatry, one of my current interests. So I've only got a few minutes left, so I'm not going to be able to go through in detail all the things. So I'll probably just pick out a couple of these. So in terms of implementation, as you might imagine, if you think you understand what a signal means or part of what a signal means, suddenly there are a huge range of different questions you'd like to ask about how do they realize in the brain. So for instance, we talked about model-based, model-free values. So how do these actually, how are these integrated? We know if you're playing a game like chess, you want to essentially integrate unless you're doing complete rollouts at the end of the game. You'd like to integrate together a tree with a model-free system when you can no longer search the tree enough, right? So this was Samuel's idea. You do a bit of tree search, and then at the end of the tree search, you then use whatever value function you get at the point there. So we actually know very little about how these systems might interact in those cases. So, reward and punishment, we talked about, dopamine interacts with other neuromodulators like serotonin, also opioids. So, for instance, so there are a lot of essentially fairly detailed questions, but these are all questions which I think that reinforcement learning is going to help us, but it gives us categories of ways of thinking about psychological data, neural data, and even ethological data too. There are some interesting battles, so we heard a little bit this morning. So it turns out that somebody asked about dopamine and choice. And indeed, there are these two studies, one in monkeys by Ginella Morris and Haggai Bergman, one in rats by Matt Roche and Jeff Schoenbaum. And they came to exactly different conclusions about control in these cases, both lovely, very carefully done experiments. So Morris collected great evidence that the monkeys were using something like salsa, and Roche got great evidence the monkeys using something like cue learning, based on what the TD prediction error signal was at the time of the choice. And so that's a wonderful question that gets you'd never even have posed it if you didn't have a sort of RL structure for there. I said briefly about these striatal spirals, these helical connections throughout the striatum. So that's a very important structure which may be involved in actually things like drugs of addiction, the way that they embed habits in a very deep way, maybe something we can get some handle on by thinking about these striatal spirals. About exploration and about temporal discounting as well. And as I said before, I think that a much underused source of data is going to come from the brain stimulation reward domain. So Peter is one of the real-world experts on that. Peter Schisgold, who's actually here. Okay, representation. So a critical thing we need to do is represent issues of representation of state. So we need to think about construction of invariances. You know, learning these value functions is very, very difficult. You know, you have value functions which are parameterized over a huge number of different variables. So you think about how do we represent the world such that we can learn, get good representations of value functions. So I think there's some nice work by Sridhar, for instance, and many others thinking about the construction of invariances. Also, partial observability is rife. You know, these, even in the very simple experiments, some Wolfram simple experiments are called trace conditioning. A stimulus comes on, then it goes out again. A second later, the animal gets a reward. At the time of the reward, the stimulus which predicts that reward is no longer there. The animal has to somehow remember the fact that the stimulus was there in order to predict this reward. It has to essentially take create a Markov decision or a Markov prediction problem out of a partially observable Markov problem by using memory. And so that's actually a sort of partial observability. So Mike Todd, Yael, others have been thinking about that. Representation of time. So something we know, you know, there are lots of hypotheses about. There was a nice poster yesterday from a nice paper by Elliot, Ludwig, Rich, and Jim Kehoe. So we know there are interesting psychological theories and computational theories about the representation of time, but there's very little neural data about how time is represented in the brain. And that's there are lots of speculation, lots of hypotheses, and hopefully the modeling will start to pose very direct questions that we can then use to go and try and test that a bit better. And then my Bayesian rift says we need to think more about the way that uncertainty is represented. So in our battle between the model-based and model-free system, I was actually helping myself to something a little bit unreasonable, which is uncertainty-sensitive model-free control, this Bayesian Q-learning. So that means that we had to have a representation of uncertainty along with this representation of value. And so we don't know anything about the way that that system might actually really represent its uncertainty, even if it does in any specific way. And then there are ideas about using more sophisticated sort of uncertainty-sensitive notions to do, some work that Aaron Corville and Nathaniel Dorr did, which are really in tune with a new scheme in sort of in cognitive science, sort of Bayesian cognitive science, which has been pushed by Josh Tenenbaum, Tom Griffiths, and their colleagues, where we're thinking about sort of big structural learning problems, which really interact in a very nice way, I think, with our reinforcement learning problems too. So there's an interesting interaction to be had there. Okay, just a couple more things. So hierarchical RL. So again, hierarchies, I know, is a word which the organizer of this workshop is not very happy with. But nevertheless, it's a problem which I think we see a lot in the thinking about the way the brain works. So the way we like to think about this, control problems have statistical structure. There's lots of underlying structure in our control problems. And that comes from internal factors, like the existence of working memory we want to use, and for external factors too. So we live in our Hobbesian sort of world where rewards are few and far between and are caused by things that we do, whereas punishments are frequent and caused by things that other animals do. So that's a particular sort of statistical structure of domains, which we would like to understand the ramification of that for the sorts of controls that we might do, sort of exploration we might do, sort of exploitation we might do too. So we'd like to infer this statistical structure from examples. So what I want to think about this is that the frontal cortex, or the PFC, is just like the visual cortex. So the visual cortex, many people think that you essentially learn the statistical structure of the visual world from examples. And that gives you a set of coordinates, a representational structure which you can represent new pictures or new images. And so the PFC should be just the same, except for actions rather than for problems, for tasks, rather than for images. So it has the same job, which is to essentially learn a statistical structure of the tasks in the domain and then recognize new tasks in old coordinates, just like new images in old coordinates. And that's going to give us essentially priors over value functions, priors over controllers, going to make us essentially make the learning problem much better. And it'll also help us understand things like transfer learning, so things like notions like shaping or instant programmability that we obviously have in the way that we structure tasks. And so we're trying to think about how can we characterize the statistics of these control problems in these domains, and what sort of task grammars should we have? So actually, this is a very open question in my lab. I really don't really know exactly how to approach that. Okay, so the last thing is computational psychiatry. So this is an area I'm very interested in at the moment. So basically, it's when good quality decision-making goes bad. So we have great models, we think, of affective decision-making, how you should do it properly. So those models should be very useful in understanding cases where the decision-making doesn't work so well. And that's, no, basically that describes psychiatric populations. They make bad decisions for a variety of different reasons. So if we understand how good decisions get made, we understand the pathologies of those systems, we should understand how bad decisions get made too. So I gave you one example, serotonin and Pavlovian inhibition. That leads to certain problems in terms of the way you evaluate the world. But there are going to be lots of others. In fact, even these diseases, the way that psychiatry currently works, if you look, their manual for psychiatric disorders called DSM-4, is basically a big list of symptoms. And they say you have this disease if you have 8 of the following 10 symptoms. Let's say for something like depression. So we don't understand as a field what the underlying pieces are. These are probably many different underlying diseases with many different causes. And so they were going to respond in different ways to different sorts of treatments. They just realize in very different ways. And so by thinking about, for instance, say this is a model-free system effect. The serotonin effect is something which we think of as model-free. But there's going to be a model-based problem too, which comes if you think that the sort of the statistical problems you're going to solve mean that you're in a world where things that you do tend not to have reliable consequences. So that's a set of paradigms called learned helplessness, and this is one of the major things which leads to the problems of depression in human subjects. Okay, so we've done some work thinking about this in the context of social decision making, where we essentially use, I won't go through all this, but we think about sort of partially observable Markov games as a way of characterizing individuals as individuals' types. And those types then essentially are factors which may go wrong in certain sorts of psychiatric disorders. So here, reinforcement learning essentially parameterizes problems and provides essentially a huge new set of tasks which simply are not used. Generally, in psychiatry, people use questionnaire-based methods of diagnosis, which are obviously extremely crude in terms of what you can elicit from those things. We would like to provide, essentially, decision-making tasks, look at what goes wrong with those decision-making tasks, and essentially inverse RL essentially amounts to doing diagnosis in these cases. So we'd like to categorize what goes wrong with people and what can go wrong with these models, and use that as a way of looking at individuals. Okay, so I just have one last thing to say before I stop, which is we heard from Andrew what the role is of theory in computer science. So there's actually which is that what the role is of theory in neuroscience, a question that also Rich asked. So this is a book by Ramanuj Kahal, who was who won the Nobel Prize in 1906, actually for his work in anatomy. Got recently translated by Neely and Larry Swanson. So it's a wonderful book, tells you all sorts of things about how you should go through the world as a scientist, including things like who you should marry and many other important questions like that. And he has one chapter, which is my favorite chapter, which is basically what goes wrong, what's going to stop you from being an effective scientist. So he calls these the diseases of the will. And what he does is provide vignettes or little personality types, all of whom are destined to fail. So contemplators, bibliophiles and polyglots, these are people who know many languages, some of them useless. That's a bad thing to say in Montreal. Megalomaniacs, I'm sure none of you have any of those in your departments. Instrument addicts, so these are people he describes as going around with too many keys in their pockets, but we can say anybody who knows their IP address of their main server is one of those. Misfits, who I'm sure there are none of at this conference. And his last category is theorists. And what he says about theorists is this. There are highly cultivated, wonderfully endowed minds whose wills suffer from a particular form of lethargy. Its undeniable symptoms include a facility for exposition, a creative and restless imagination, an aversion to the lab, and an indomitable dislike for concrete science and seemingly unimportant data. When faced with a difficult problem, they feel an irresistible urge to formulate a theory rather than question nature. As might be expected, disappointments plague the theorist. Thank you. Sadly, he wasn't a neuroscientist. I think sadly they're only talking about theory in neuroscience, but it's a good question. Yeah?
Just the thought that I heard the first time about computational psychiatry just popped up in my mind that delusional symptoms like schizophrenia, maybe it's when model based stuff took over everything else.
Yes, absolutely, yes. I have a student who's interested in modeling delusion formation in schizophrenia. So there's a task in that domain where it's called the bead in the jar task. So you tell the subjects there are two jars, one of which contains more green than blue marbles, the other one contains more blue than green. And you draw marbles and you say, and you ask subjects just to declare when they're happy to say which of the two jars it comes from. And the observation is that schizophrenic patients, they have this what's called a jump into conclusions bias. So after a very small amount of data, they'll jump to the conclusion, maybe even one marble, they'll jump to the conclusion that this jar is one jar, is the blue jar or the green jar. And so what we did was some modeling to look at their decision making. And there's a sort of reinforcement learning problem where you can ask the question, which is, so we built a model of how they should collect evidence and make these choices. And we said there are costs of sampling, you know, to get extra things, and there's cost of making an error. And there's a chance of there's a noise aspect to this decision making. And what it turns out, although people thought that the subjects would jump to conclusions, they actually made incorrect inferences in this case, you can show there's independent data showing that, in fact, schizophrenics are perfectly good at about reasoning about the evidence, about learning the probabilities. But they still make these decisions early. And the conclusion we came to is they make them early because they have noise in decision making, which is actually consistent with what you'd see in a PFC problem. And that means that it's not worth their while sampling longer because they're not going to be able to express the benefits of that extra sampling in good quality decisions that come out. So this is what Michael Matusis did. So it's an example where, again, you can use an RL-like construct, in this case, information accumulation decision-making over time, in order to try and understand something about the mechanisms that might be going wrong in a disease like schizophrenia, in this little aspect of schizophrenia. Yeah, Hamid.
I have a question about reinforcement learning committees. So people either use model-based reinforcement learning or model-free. So, do you have any insight how to integrate these things together? Because normally you are.
Well, so all I can tell you is the way that rats do it, the way we imagine rats to do it. So, it looks like they have both systems running simultaneously. The reason we know that is because I showed you the case where you do lidocaine in the hippocampus, right? So it's temporarily activated. There's actually experiments by Simon Kilcross and Kutteru where what they did was to temporarily inactivate a different part of the prefrontal cortex. And you show there are sort of neighboring parts of the prefrontal cortex when you inactivate them, where one of them you inactivate it, it means that the animal starts off looking like it's habitual, so already it doesn't show devaluation. Then the other parts means that late on in learning it looks like it's still goal-directed. So again, you can really manipulate these two systems. So it makes sense, we're arguing that it makes sense to have both these systems because they work well in different parts of space. Now, of course, in a computer, faces a very different sort of sampling problem. You know, a robot faces a very different sampling problem from the rats. The way that computations work is very different, right? So we can afford, you know, courtesy of our 800 cores to go and, you know, sample these trees all the way down to the end. So in that case, it might never be a good idea for those cases to use, you know, model-based reinforcement learning. Use model-free reinforcement learning because you can always get the benefit of using model-based reinforcement learning. But, you know, we suffer or enjoy a particular sort of architecture. And so for us, we have to do this balancing. And so it may well be that balancing is also something we would see in some sorts of problems that come up in this domain. But of course, our computational power is very different from the power that we have.
Reinforcement learning also suffers from sometimes with that model. It's like some models like LSTD, for example.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So thinking about the uncertainties is a great thing to do in that case.
One last question?
Yeah.
Did you show the mice the bottle of poison? And if you had, do you think you would have seen a difference in learning rates, convergence back to the optimal from the model free versus the model?
Sorry, you mean if you just show them the...
You expand the state space so that they're aware, if they have additional information that might lead them to know that there's poison. Is this just a case where you sort of just collapse two MDPs on each other, or you replace one for another? And if you expanded the state space, they'd be able to discern that the gene was poison, or they'd have some place to put that.
Okay, so if they get to eat the cheese, if they press the lever and eat the cheese, and so you poison the cheese, you come back, the habitual animal will press the lever, whereas the gold-rated one doesn't. If you let him then eat the cheese, which he will do at that point, if you can show him the cheese, he won't even eat the cheese at that point. So he already knows the cheese is no good. It's just that he will press the lever to try and get it nevertheless. And then, if you give him it again, he won't press the lever even. Which means that he can then put that piece of data together. So the piece of data, that pressing the lever, gets the cheese. And then he has his aha moment, which in this case is just a piece of cue learning, which says, okay, well, it wasn't worth my while pressing the lever. But in fact, I don't want the cheese that comes out as a result of that. And then he will reduce his pressing of the lever. So the way they do these experiments is in extinction. So they don't actually give the animal the cheese when he presses the lever to make sure that he doesn't actually have the chance to do that. Now, you could say, imagine that I give animals, you know, lots and lots of experience with poisoning, you know, different serially different foods one after the other? Will they then have this strong? Will they then develop this sort of strong expectation that this, you know, the cheese will become devalued at this point? We don't really know the answer to that, but I think the answer is probably not. But there are certainly lots of other cases where they can essentially incorporate motivational state into their value function, and then they will actually therefore be able to learn in the bigger space. They expand the state space, as you're suggesting, and they will know then, as a function of, you know, whether they're hungry or not, whether it's worth, you know, whether it's worth pressing the lever. And so to test these systems very precisely, you have to of course remove that possibility and therefore use things like novel foods that they don't know the values of when they're sated, for instance, and things like that. So they've done some work along those lines, and indeed it looks like you can take your motivational state and you can incorporate that in your state space, and so then it becomes something which the habitual system also has access to, just as you suggest.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you.